my job of teaching people is to show them how to practice. And if something's not feeling right in the practice, that's what I'm trying to keep them on track with, so that they know like how to rest, how to play certain exercises, what to think about. And the goal of it is that at the end of all their practicing, they feel better, so that they feel like, wow, now I can do even more, you know, instead of the practice routine being like they're wiped out at the end and feel like they can't do anything. So that's where, I mean, some of that, I mean, that comes from Claude Gordon too, that, I mean, the routine shouldn't be like it tears you down. It should make you feel better and build you up.
This episode contains adult language and adult humor.
Since when have trumpet players ever been considered adults?
If you are easily offended by these types of conversations, consider switching to the oboe. Welcome to the Trumpet Gurus Hang podcast. I'm your host, Jose Johnson. My guest for this episode is Jeff Pirtle. Jeff, well, he's a systematic kind of guy. As a student of the legendary Claude Gordon, Jeff was taught more than just how to play the trumpet. Jeff absorbed Claude's passion for teaching and his knack for helping students develop a systematic approach to daily practice. Jeff is thoughtful, insightful, and a lifelong learner, and he's always willing to help others find a better way. So, pour yourself a big glass, pull up a chair, and let the hang begin! All right, here we are back at the hang, and this time I am joined by the one and only Jeff Pirtle. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jose. I'm pleased to be here and honored that you're interviewing me.
Oh man, this is going to be great. I know you've got so much insight and so many stories to share, and it's going to be hard to kind of get everything condensed into one episode, but we'll do our best here. Before we go any further, I do have to mention, one, your room looks great. I like all of the accoutrement back there. That's really wonderful. But I have to start out by really complimenting you on your t-shirt.
I have to tell Michael that I wore it.
Yeah. Michael Barkley, obviously, one of the show sponsors, the creator of the Barkley microphone, which I use exclusively here. Mike's such a great guy. He's a fun guy. He's doing some really good stuff for us trumpet players. So this is just a reminder, if you haven't gotten your Michael Barkley or Barkley microphone, you should really check him out. And maybe he'll send you a t-shirt, which he still hasn't sent me. So Mike, when I see you, you're in trouble, dude. So anyway, Jeff, let's just get going on you a little bit more. You're down in Greenville.
Yeah, Greenville, South Carolina.
Yeah.
About halfway between Charlotte, North Carolina, and Atlanta.
I know the region well. Played there quite a bit during the 80s, down through that corridor. And actually, my family, my mom and my sister, both moved down to South Carolina. So I make the trek down 95 a lot of times to get down there. So,
okay. What part of South Carolina?
They're living right outside of Charleston, or not Charleston. Charleston.
Yeah, I usually go down to Charleston and Hilton Head for vacation. My girlfriend's daughter is down in Charleston, so we go down there and also Hilton Head. So I know 95. I'm up off of 85.
Yeah. So that's cool. So how long have you been down in that area?
I moved here in 1997.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it's beautiful down there. You know, if you've never had the opportunity to get through that area, man, you know, you got to do it. Just make sure it's good weather. You know, it's no fun driving around down there when it gets nasty. So, but Jeff, you've been doing a whole lot with I've been seeing a lot of your posts that you've been doing in terms of the use of or finding an efficient practice method. And I really find that fascinating because practice is something that we all should do it. We don't always do it. We don't always do it the most beneficial or efficient way. What kind of sparked your passion to look at putting together kind of these individualized packages for people to
excuse me, to help them to find the best way for them to make improvements?
Yeah. Okay. So the little YouTube shorts, I decided I was going to do those because a lot of people don't take the time to listen to something that's really long. And I thought it would be something that hopefully if I could state something really clear in under 60 seconds, that would maybe get them interested in more of the things that's on, that are on my website and what I'm doing. I studied with Claude Gordon 10 years. And I think one of the things that made his teaching so unique is it, just like what you're describing, it was focusing on practice. It's like not equipment, mouthpieces, gadgets, anything like that. It's like the most helpful thing that we can do is know how to practice. And that involves practice routines, method books, how to combine them all together, and what you think about what you do when you practice. So that's what I'm trying to do with the one. Like usually on Wednesdays, I put one out that answers a question. And then on a Monday, I put one out that tries to summarize a method book. And I'm starting with the different method books that I think are probably the most important ones that people should get first. And then as I get through all those, I'm going to go into some of the other ones and explain them a little bit more. But it's kind of hard to summarize things in 60 seconds.
Yeah, well, you know, that is the tough part. Our attention spans have shortened considerably over our lifetime. We definitely are. I remember the way it's called, like the MTV mentality, you know, the fast cut sort of thing, and it's gotten even faster than that. So now with things like, you know, TikTok and Instagram, the stories and YouTube reels and things like that, the need for this kind of really short, super digestible content has become required. I don't think it will never or should never replace long form content, because you can't get into the details. But if we can get them in the door, then that's when we can offer them a little bit more. So with your experiences, you know, say you studied with Claude for 10 years. I mean, how did you meet him? How did that happen? And you know, what are some of the big lessons that you learned from him?
Yeah, I was, and when you mentioned the long format content, I'm trying to do that too and post more of that. I hosted like 3 brass camps back in 2010, 11, 12. And even though it's like 12 years later, I'm finally getting around to like editing all the videos and putting them up. So there's some longer format things on there with some things that I felt were maybe a little bit controversial that clarified some things. Like, for example, one of the recent ones I put up was from a Dr. Larry Miller that's talking about the diaphragm and breathing. And there's a lot of misconceptions and misnomers about it. And he's a medical doctor specializing in cardiovascular surgery. And he was a trumpet player. And he's still alive, but I think he's not in good health right now. But that's like a longer format thing. But on to your question about how I got started with Claude. I'm 54 right now. I'll turn 55 in December. But I remember I was in middle school and starting trumpet in 4th grade. And there's this older man that I bought a trumpet from, and maybe in 5th grade, and he used to go to all my different concerts. Later find out he was friends with like Chuck Finley and some of these other guys there in LA. And he'd tell me about these different things, and he'd show up at my concerts. And then one time he gave me this little pamphlet that was about Claude Gordon, and it had high notes and pedal tones and stuff. And I looked at it and was like, wow, can anyone do that on the trumpet? And I just like didn't really do much with that, but I kept it. And then I was a freshman in high school, and there was a guy that was a senior, and we both took from the same guy in Bakersfield, California, named Charles Brady, who had been this great orchestral trumpet player that played in the National Symphony. And for 6 years, he was principal trumpet. And he'd also recorded with Stravinsky and done some other things that he never told anyone about, but I later found out about. And then he had some of the best students there in Bakersfield. And this one guy I kind of looked up to, kind of as like an older brother. I was sitting right next to him in an honor band, in Kern County Honor Band. And he told me about Claude Gordon. He was like, oh man, you got to get these books, get this. And I bought them, and I didn't know what to do with them. So we were going along he graduated, started playing at Bakersfield Junior College, which was a couple blocks from my house. And he said, hey, we need another trumpet player. You want to play in the jazz band? And I was like, that's cool, because my high school didn't have a jazz band, and get to play with a bunch of college kids was pretty awesome. So he told me we did a musical before. I think it was one of my first paying gigs. And he was telling me about starting lessons with Claude Gordon, and I heard him improve. And then we were playing in this jazz band, and within about 8 or 9 months, he was improving a lot. And I started thinking, man, that was pretty cool. And then all of a sudden he started getting worse. And I was like, he was like this really big buffed out dude. And didn't want to say anything like condescending to him, but I was wondering, what are you doing? And he was like, oh, I stopped with Claude Gordon because I couldn't pop out a double high C after 8 months. So it's not doing what I want, but I could hear all this improvement. And he had like a G that was like huge and better than most professional trumpet players. And I knew like whatever he was doing was working, and whatever he's doing now is not. So I had, around that time, I also had an accident where I broke off my front tooth that had to be crowned. And I went through all this crazy stuff where I was trying different mouthpieces and my playing was getting worse. And I was kind of at my wit's end. I didn't know what to do. And I begged my mom. My dad had already passed away at that time. I had older parents that adopted me when they were like 55. And so my dad died my freshman year in high school. And so my mom said, you know, do you really think you think this is going to be worth it? And I was like, I think so. And she said, you better get something out of it. So I went. And after this brass camp, it was the first time where I heard someone really articulate, like, here's the way it works. Here's why you should do it this way. Here's books you should use to practice. Here's how you can develop to be really great at all these different skills. And also around the same time, the main reason I wanted to study with him, because I'd heard Maynard Ferguson at Disneyland when I was a freshman in high school. And I'd heard all these guys like Stan Mark playing double C's. And I thought, man, everyone can play a double C except for me. What's wrong with me? How can I do this? And I was like, there has to be something that I don't know. So that was my whole reason, was to try to do high notes. And then I went to the camp, and the first thing Claude Gordon wanted me to do, I mean, this is another thing that it was, people had like he had a waiting list for maybe 2 or 3 years. And I asked, is there any way that I could get private lessons with you? And he said, well, I think I have a time slot. Here's my phone number. Give me a call. And I talked to my mom, and she was like, well, I don't know about this. It was going to be a lot more money and have to drive about 100 miles to LA. And so he said, here, I have this time. Mondays at 5 o'clock. And I was like, oh, I get out of school at 3:30 and it takes 2 hours. And he was like, take it or leave it. That's all I have. So I was like, let's do it. And my mom worked it out to where I'd get out of school early, and we'd drive to LA. And I mean, I liked getting out of classes because I wasn't like the biggest academic sort of student. But so then I studied with him and changed several things immediately. Like my armature was down pretty low, so I went through that. I changed my single tonguing, my breathing, my hand position. And then what my other teacher before would always tell me, my technique was bad, but he wouldn't give me any specific assignments. But with Claude, immediately we were playing all our major scales, and, you know, like playing Clark's technical studies. And some of my friends and my band director was like, what have you been doing? You like sound a lot better, and you know your scales now. And I was like, really? And I was really thinking about the high notes. So I was just following what he was telling me to do. But all these other things, my playing were getting better. And as time went on, I realized that I was starting to play a lot of different things better and could play so much easier. And as I went to college at Cal State Northridge. I studied with a guy named Bill Bing, who's like a really, really nice guy. And there were some other people there like Roy Popper and a lot of different friends that were playing in different things. And through meeting Claude Gordon and some of his students, I'd a lot of connections with some of the students that are playing gigs, and it just ended up being a really cool thing. And I taught at his brass camps, kind of practical application stuff, demonstrated a few times, and then took a pedagogy class with him that he really only extended the invitation to be in it if he thought that you'd take it long enough that you understood some of the stuff. So I knew, I mean, backing up, I mean, we can talk about more stuff, but I knew probably as early as maybe like second or third grade that I wanted to teach privately. I wanted to play the trumpet in first grade when I saw Doc Severinsen, and then I heard Lee Lochnane on the radio playing Saturday in the Park when I was maybe in third grade. My parents didn't want me to do music, but I kept persisting and begging him until in fourth grade I got a trumpet. And I don't think I was a natural. Literally, I could not make a note out of the stupid thing for about a week. And my sisters and my mom and dad grabbed the trumpet and said, "What's wrong with you? We can make sounds out of it." And I was like, "Oh, really? I want to play the trumpet." So I don't think I was natural in any way possible, but I mean, I just kept sticking with it because I wanted to do it so bad.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's certainly something to be said for that, though. You know, it's going through the struggle to do it that makes it that much more enjoyable, at least I think. But it you know, it also sounds like you through your process, especially working with Claude, you know, learning that, I would like to say success leaves clues, you know, that people that have learned, particularly people who have had a methodical approach to learning to play, they have discovered some things that the naturals miss. So, you know, as a teacher, I mean, how was the interaction with Claude? I mean, I know that some people, you know, there's some teachers that are just kind of, you know, super, super cash. And then there are some that are just, you know, really taskmasters. You know, where was his teaching style on that kind of spectrum?
Yeah, this, I would say probably the thing that was always the case was every single lesson was super encouraging. But it wasn't like filling you with like BS or something, but he really believed that, hey, if you do it this way and you work on this, you can be a really great player. So if I came in from like, you know, kind of frustrated with some stuff at school or some discouraging things, I knew that I'd come out of a lesson, I'd be pumped up to go, okay, I'm gonna go back and practice. I want to go practice. It was like but without like forcing you to do it, it was like exciting. You like wanted to go do all this stuff that he told you to do. He always wore a business suit. I don't do that when I'm teaching, but his thing was like, he'd always wear a coat and a tie and sat at a big desk. And the thing that was pretty cool about him that I've had a few teachers in the past that I think are just really master teachers. Had a guy in martial arts named Ken Nagayama in California. They used his studio for like the first two Karate Kid movies. And him and Claude, they had a knack of just using a few words. Like, I'd say, okay, do this, or here, just change this a little bit. Like, whoa, what did you just do? You just hardly told me anything, and now everything's like working better. And so he had a knack for doing that, and he would observe you. And this is similar to the way I teach, where he would have you start into the new material. We wouldn't necessarily go back and review all the stuff that he did in the previous lesson, but he knew that by giving you the new routine and you're going through it, he could tell kind of what you're doing and kind of see what your progress was. And if something needed to be adjusted, he could do that. So he made really good, efficient use of the time. He never was really, he was super kind and encouraging, but you say like taskmaster, I wouldn't really describe him as that so much, because it was like really motivating, but you better do like what he told you to do. Like, for example, one of my one of my college roommates took from him, and he didn't do what he was supposed to do. He'd like not practice. He'd screw around with mouthpieces all the time. Because Claude was big on just saying, hey, just play one and do the practice and don't be like getting crazy with changing horns and mouthpieces. You got to like practice. And so my roommate wouldn't do it. And I would usually get early to my lesson. And it's one of the few times where he like chewed out the guy. And I came into my lesson being like, okay, I better like do what I'm told because I don't want to be chewed out for an hour, you know. But it really never happened to me, except about the only time I ever got scolded was Claude went through cancer and stopped teaching for maybe like 8 or 9 months. And there were several of us that basically begged him to come back. And around the same time with myself, I was kind of questioning if I should do music or trumpet or what with my life. Cause a lot of things are just kind of like, should I really be doing this? What have I been spending my time on? And a couple of my friends took me out to lunch and dinner and like kind of had a talk with me and said, yeah, whether you do this as a career or not, this is kind of like your thing and you're good at it and understand it. And I was like, okay. So I got back with lessons with Claude. For some weird reason, I'd like start copying the hand position of this guy, Bill Bing. And Claude looked at me and said, what are you doing that for with your thumb? I was like, what? And so for some weird reason, I was bending my thumb where he would teach everyone to like keep their thumb straight. So your hand positions like that and stuff like that. And so he was like, come over here, put a piece of tape on my hand around my knuckle, said, here, play like that. And then it was like, keep that on your hand and drive back home and then practice later. So I had like a 3-hour drive with this tape. So within one day, I like broke that habit. But that was like about the only time and one other time I like to get to his lesson about 2.5-3 hours outside of Los Angeles. And I lived in Valencia later. And I would usually go out through the desert in California and cut through the backside of the mountain up in Big Bear. So I liked it because I could drive like super fast through the desert. Once I got to the lesson, I forgot one of my books. And he was like, have you been practicing? Why did you forget your book? And I was like, seriously, I know it from memory. And he was like, okay. you had to practice what he told you to do. So, I mean, that is a taskmaster, but it never felt like I was being forced to do it, you know?
Yeah, I think that is a sign of a great teacher is you have that mixture of obviously you need to have the knowledge, but it's the ability to communicate it. And it's the communication of the information, but then it's the motivation, because if you don't have the right balance of that, you know, you can put out the best stuff, but if you aren't doing it in a way that motivates people. I even hesitate to use words motivation, because motivation is an intrinsic thing, and it's creating the environment or the spark that people can then use to find their motivation. It's having all those things together, having expectations. And having expectations for your students, having expectations for yourself, you know, all these wonderful little ingredients that come into being a phenomenal teacher. So, but it's the inspiration, I think, to me that, you know, all the great teachers I've had have inspired me in most of the times, it's not particularly in the technical skill that I'm trying to get from them. It's in some very broad aspect of you know, like their concepts on life and living, or sometimes it's a very succinct thing about some area outside of their particular craft. So you know, like with Claude, what were some of the things that you looked at from him and said, you know, I would like to model myself after these portions of his personality or his view of music and life?
Yeah, I mean, like some of the things you were talking about, like character traits with him, he was like super hardworking, determined, and disciplined. I mean, things like that, that, I mean, in a way that I don't think I've seen very many people ever be this way. Like he would not to like say that everyone had to do this, but he would just share with people, like, for example, he went, I think like 15 years without missing a day's practice. So I was like, man, I wonder if I can do that. So, I mean, with that being told I need to do that, I'd say, I wonder how long I can go. So I went like 3.5 years without missing a single day. And I mean, I think that, I mean, that like seeing that sort of thing, or seeing that he was so determined, and in some ways it could have been, I think in some ways it was not necessarily a good thing for him. Like, for example, he had cancer in his throat, like lymph nodes and stuff. And he did radiation, and he absolutely insisted that he was going to do his brass camp. And I don't know how he pulled it off, but he looked like he was like close to death when he was at this thing, and he was barely making it, but it's like, nobody was going to tell him that he couldn't do it. And I mean, he was that kind of guy where if you told him something couldn't be done, he didn't care. He was going to do it. You know, it's like, so whether it's something on the trumpet or anything, he was just that determined. So that's kind of cool. And I think there are people that are in lots of different fields that are like that. And, you know, successful people don't give up when it's something seems to be an obstacle. They're just like either figure out how to make it through or persist or something like that. So that's like some cool things about him. I mean, his playing, this is kind of a really unusual thing. I never actually heard him play one note in a trumpet lesson. So over 10 years, he never played one single note. I heard him demonstrate a few things at some of his brass camps, and I heard recordings of him. But he had like the knack of being able to say things with words or tell you what to do to like make things work better. And the assignments and knowing what to give you at the right time. And now with my teaching, especially younger students, I'll definitely play with them. And, you know, with my older students, if I need to get them to understand something better, it's easier to just pick up my trumpet and say, here, do it like this. Here's what it's supposed to sound like or feel like, and here's what I'm talking about. So where for me before Claude, the guy that I took from before, all our lessons consisted of was just playing along with him and hearing him play. And he sounded musical and beautiful, and he was playing like very correct, but he didn't tell me how to do it. So it was kind of like they were quite different. And I can understand taking from both types of teachers. But I mean, I think that for most people that are not like a natural, it's the way Claude does it and did it made a lot more sense to me, at least.
Well, yeah, I think it's real important to find a teacher that meshes with you. There's an old saying, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher shall appear. And that, you know, sometimes we're just not ready to get the information, or we're not in the right environment. And when we find that teacher who can speak to us in a way that we understand, then that's when the magic can really happen. And, I think that now it could be as you're telling your story, because you know, I've gone through with a lot of the people that I've studied with, whether it be music or martial arts or things like that, that I usually had to travel a great distance in order to find the people that had the skills that I wanted to learn. But now with the advent of technology, of streaming technology, now it's so much easier for us to get access to great teachers. But however, you have to kind of weed through the process, because, you know, any Joe with a laptop, or you don't even need a laptop anymore, you just use your phone, can do lessons, can offer lessons. But not everybody is either A, skilled enough in the pedagogy, or B, has the analytical ability to actually communicate the right steps to a person. So, you know, for someone who's been in this business for a while, what are some of the things the advantages you've seen being created by technology? And then what are some of the drawbacks, and how are you trying to create the best of both worlds?
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Yeah, that's really good. I mean, I've been doing this online teaching officially since about 2003. But some of the stuff you're talking about makes me think of, like, when I first started doing it and when more people started doing it, I knew that I didn't want to just be a trumpet teacher on the internet, because, I mean, how many people are on the internet? And if all you are is a trumpet teacher on the internet, then it's going to be a race to the bottom with how much you get paid. You know, be like, oh, this person charges this. I'll pick the cheapest person. I mean, it's like, it's same thing with like being a musician like that. There's got to be something that's a little bit different. So I knew that from taking with Claude and all the different things that I understand about method books and practice routines and showing people how to do all this stuff that I've done, I wanted them to understand that. So that's why I created my website to begin with. It kind of came about because a friend of mine told me about Trumpet Herald, and they're like, hey, there's a Trumpet Herald forum. This is a long time ago, early 2000s. And that there's a discussion group about Claude Gordon. And even this guy and some other Claude Gordon students were putting stuff up there. I was like, Claude didn't really say that. That's kind of frustrating that they were saying stuff that was opposite what he said. Like, one guy was saying taking a pencil and squeezing on it, and another guy was saying playing smaller mouthpieces. Claude would have said that. I was like, no, he wouldn't. But I didn't want to get on there and like slam on these guys. They were sort of my friends, you know. So it's like, instead, I put a bunch of audio of Claude so I could say, hey, take a listen to this. And then Claude would talk about it. And then it was not me saying it, but it was Claude. And hopefully it made more sense. And it was coming from someone that was, you know, like well-known and respected and older. And then I added more content as time went on and tried to clarify and make things so that it would give people different things to think about when they practice. Now back to your question about like what sorts of things have I noticed that are different. So that's like a big thing about setting yourself apart as being different. With the technology side of things, I got into video chat on the internet probably as early as about 1993 or 1994. I'm really big into like electronics and technology. I've been a ham operator since about 1982. So about 40 years I've done that. When I was in about first grade and my friends were wanting to play with Legos, I asked my parents for Christmas for this thing called Electrolab. And it was kind of like little magnetic schematic, like resistors, capacitors, transistors, and you could build like an oscillator or a strobe light or a amplifier. I was playing around with that kind of stuff because I just thought that was super cool. And then didn't start playing trumpet till later. And then so when the internet came around, I'd already played around with slow scan TV over ham radio and knew that, wow, there's a way to like send pictures to people. And I had some friends that had fast scan TV, so they could actually send 30 frames a second to another part of the area with a camera. So I thought, this is pretty neat. And I knew just the way like the internet and the first modems. I remember playing around with when I was in seventh or eighth grade, my math teacher got myself and another guy an account at a local college, that Bakersfield College, and they had a mainframe computer. It was like a DEC, Digital Equipment Corporation mainframe. And we'd play around with that. And I figured out how to get a modem to dial in. And it was like all these things that with computers and ham radio and communication and electronics. And then when the internet came about, I remember going over to my friend's house and thinking, man, this is like really cool. And it was nothing. It was like, there was no web. We were hooking into library systems. Like, we can communicate to another part of the world. This is going to be cool. And did video chat with this program called See You, See Me. And it was kind of really nerdy, where it was just like people like waving at each other with a little black and white camera going, hey, I'm in the Netherlands and I'm in California or whatever. But even before I moved from California to South Carolina, I was living in Los Angeles. My now ex-wife, she was telling me that she was like, I'm not moving to Los Angeles. And I was like, well, I can move there and I'll teach on the internet eventually. She thought I like lost my mind, but this was like 1996. I was like, it's going to happen. Because I could see the internet was getting faster, the cameras getting better, the computers getting better. This is going to happen. And so it was about 2003 or four that I started really like dabbling with it. I created a website around that time, and a guy who's now, he stopped and now he's back again, his name is Sean Hines. He's from somewhere in Connecticut or Boston. But he was my first student. So it's like my first student is now taken with me again. And so it's like he sought me out because of Claude Gordon stuff, and it just kept going. And then about 2008, when the market collapsed and all these bad things happened, both my ex-wife and I lost a lot of students. Like, I think probably, I was probably up to about 60 students at that time, and I probably lost about 20, and she probably lost about 20. So we're talking about thousands of dollars of lost income a month. And I was like, oh no. And, but then the online stuff was already going and started taking off more. And I was like, well, this is pretty cool. It's like, this is actually keeping me afloat. And then more people started thinking it was a real thing. And as time went on, I mean, I've changed my website several times. And what I did maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but it's been at least 5 years, I decided I wanted to make it better. So that my dream was that I could grab my laptop, my trumpet, and basically go any place in the world and teach. And so I scanned every single, some of it I did myself, some of it I sent to different services, but every single page of every method book, solo, text about trumpet, everything. It's like over 50,000 to maybe 60,000 pages of stuff I have in PDF. So I can just pull it up on my computer, have everything. And so if I'm teaching a student, I've got this giant file cabinet, but I don't even need to pull it up. I can pull it up on my phone or my computer, or my iPad. And if a student's off in a foreign country or something, I'll be like, hey, you need to order this book, but let me send you a page out of it. And I send him a page. So it, that makes it very convenient. And then several years ago, when I did my last revamp on my website, you can't see this when you're looking at it without being logged, without being a student, but there's like a private section where you could go create a free account, but my students, I click a box and they can like see a section that lists off their assignments. So I've got there, I mean, I've taught a lot more than this, but I've got about 20,000 assignments, like all the assignments from 20,000 lessons are in my website for the last 10 or so years. So I can go back in there and like pull up a student that I haven't seen for a while and say, oh, you were last doing this. And we went through this book and we did this and we did these sets of exercises and that. So I can keep track of every single student independently and know, like if they email me a question and say, hey, I'm practicing this and my routine seems to be making me stiff, I pull up their assignment, look through it and say, let's change this a little bit here. Let me know in a day or two what it's feeling like. Cause I try to like keep that interaction between people. So I look at it as like my job of teaching people is to show them how to practice. And if something's not feeling right in the practice, that's what I'm trying to keep them on track with, so that they know like how to rest, how to play certain exercises, what to think about. And the goal of it is that at the end of all their practicing, they feel better, so that they feel like, wow, now I can do even more, you know, instead of the practice routine being like they're wiped out at the end and feel like they can't do anything. So that's where, I mean, some of that, I mean, that comes from Claude Gordon too, that, I mean, the routine shouldn't be like it tears you down. It should make you feel better and build you up.
That's interesting. Really interesting. And so, you know, like when we're talking about the changes in technology, yeah, definitely. Like I can remember dial up, and then, you know, DSL was a big thing. And then, you know, now that we're into to fiber optics and things like that, and we're seeing speeds increase. There's still a difference between being in a room with someone and doing things virtually. And for me, because I've taught for years, you know, face-to-face with people, but, you know, I've done over the past probably 8 years or so, a lot more virtual work. You have to develop a different skill set because you can't physically be there. So how can you explain a physical concept or a acoustic concept that maybe isn't going to translate as well over the internet as it would in person? So have you found that to be true, that where you've had to adjust your methodology a little bit and find new and different ways of expressing concepts?
Right. There are some things where, of course, because I physically can't be there, you know, most of the people now that I teach are virtual. Even a few of the people that are local decide to do virtual. I prefer, especially if they're younger, that they come in person. I think that, especially when you're younger, it's harder to teach a younger person. I'm saying like, you know, like sixth, seventh grade or somewhere around that area, that age, because keeping their focus on you is hard unless they're very attentive kid, you know, but often that's not the case. But so that's like probably the hardest thing for me. With adults, it's easier. With the physical thing that you're talking about, I can't play along with students in their lessons like my first teacher did, because no matter how good the internet is, there's no possible way, because you got lag time for the signal to get to you and get back to me. And if you play with what got to you 15 milliseconds later, then it gets back to me 30 milliseconds later and we're no longer together. So that's not possible. There is one, I don't know if you know about this, but there was a thing called Digital Musicians Network. It was a technology that someone tried to do as a plug-in for different digital audio workstations like Pro Tools or Logic or whatever, that allowed you to synchronize with other people through MIDI time code. And it sort of worked, but it's still not the same, you know. But so as far as like adjusting to teaching online, some of the thing I was mentioning with having the assignment sheets entered in the computer is part of it. Like when I first started doing it, when I first started teaching lessons, I'd write my assignments all out by hand. One of the things that makes Claude Gordon, like the way he taught, when I teach a little bit different, is every single thing that I give to a student, like I want them to know, start with this, your breathing exercises, do this book, these pages, this book, this book, this book. It's all written down. So there's no guesswork of just randomly going through stuff, because having the routine to be consistent gives you a way to like know you're practicing a consistent way. I'm making little tweaks on it each week, and then you'll understand what made you play better. So when I was first doing it handwritten, it's like I can't handwrite it and like send it to someone. So I first used a database program and I'd send a PDF page of that. And then now it's built in my site to do that. So that had to change. The PDFs of the book was something that had to change, because that way I didn't have to wait for them to get the book. I could immediately get them on the exercises. camera angle and lighting and stuff like that. You know, usually like in the first lesson with people, I'll say, okay, like I personally will tell people, like, stand so I can see you from your left side, so I can see their hand position the way I want to see their from their waist to their head. And that way I'm able to look at their body exactly what I want to see all the time. And then when they're, sometimes a guy get them to adjust the volume, because when they're playing along and they do something wrong, I'll be like, stop, let's fix it. I don't want them to just keep going. I'll be like, okay, right here, well, let's like change this. So, I mean, that's where I'm probably more like, you know, like pre-blunt and direct, say, stop this right here and let's do it this other way. But as far as playing along or playing a duet or something like that, that's something that's limiting. But for my way of teaching, that doesn't really pose a problem. I think for some people it would. My ex-wife is an oboe player, and she tried teaching online with some of that before, and I helped her out to try to, you know, we were married and stuff, and even, you know, trying to tell her how to do some stuff. But with an instrument like oboe, I mean, you can't go grab someone's reed and like take your knife out and adjust it when you're not physically there. And you can't like grab their instrument and look at it to see if you need to adjust it. So sometimes if I have a student where I think something's messed up with their horn, that's a little bit different, because I'll be like, okay, show me what's going on. Where if they're in person, I'd be able to say, hold on, let me play it. Oh, there's something wrong with it. So that's kind of a limiting thing with that. But for the most part, I can kind of hear and figure that out. And then it becomes a little bit different, because I can't physically like touch their horn or stuff, or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting challenge. I mean, I like challenges. So it's, it's kind of like the thing that Einstein, the quote Einstein had, you know, if you can't explain something, paraphrases, if you can't explain a concept, simply, that means you don't understand it well enough. So I think to me, that's always been, that becomes a challenge, is like, how can I improve my ability to understand things so that I can explain it to anybody? I think that working around the barriers of technology, you know, there's certainly, it's a give and take. So it's given us the ability to have access to more people. It gives us that real-time access. But, you know, there's certainly some drawbacks to it. So it's how do we work with it? And how do we make, you know, work to with it to not only improve the skills of our students, but how do we use it to improve our teaching skills? So I just like that idea. I do want to ask you this. So, you know, as a teacher, and someone, especially someone who, you know, your unique selling proposition, as it were, is your ability to help people to develop sustainable routines that will give them the market results that they're looking for. So with your years of practice as a teacher, what are the top three things that you see as being the areas that need to be addressed the most frequently?
Is like Clyde would always stress like breathing and what he would call wind power. So I think that a lot of people's problems come back to that, whether it's their posture, where they're standing and they're letting their chest collapse when they're playing, and they're not supporting and having good posture and taking a big breath when they're playing. Knowing how to like play and feel, where the idea of like feeling how your trumpet interacts with you, with the wind power and the tongue level. So that usually with most all my students, one of the things that I think is a pretty dramatic change that I would say probably at least 90% of them would notice this after the first 3 months, is that how much easier things can be once you kind of get the idea of coordinating your wind power and your tongue level. Most people don't practice flexibility studies that much or the way they should, and they kind of miss some of the benefit of how that could help their playing. And so I think getting them to know how to work on those exercises and the feel that they're going for and what to think about when they're doing it can make it to where they discover, wow, this can actually be easier. And I kind of look at it as if someone might be coming to me for lessons for improving their endurance or their range or their power or control or whatever. And I look at those things as byproducts of playing easier. And if you can learn how to play easier, those other things will happen. You don't have to worry about whatever high note you're getting to, but most trumpet players get crazy about that and think like, oh, I want to be able to play higher. It's like, forget about messing with mouthpieces or other stuff. Just play these exercises a certain way and let it change you over time. And then as that starts working, then they kind of grasp like what the practicing and the routines have actually done for them. And then they see like, wow, okay, now I want to practice more because it's done something, you know. I hope that makes sense. I don't know if that answered your question really good or not.
Yeah, well, man, it's your answer, so I like it. you know, and you've talked about, you know, utilizing, helping people to utilize the different method books that are out there. And I mean, there's certainly no shortage of method books. I think that it's kind of interesting, like, you know, especially because of your relationship with Claude. And as you were saying about like with the trumpet herald and stuff, that it's very easy to misinterpret what the author had to say. And no matter how clearly we think we're being in our explanations, there's always this room for interpretation. And that's why sometimes it's so good to go, if you can't go directly to the source themselves, if they're no longer with us, it's finding the most knowledgeable or, you know, experienced person who has the deepest understanding of those concepts. There's a lot of these method books that are out there, and people don't understand how to actually utilize them or how to make them a part of their day-to-day practice. So, throwing this out to you, if you had to say, hey, these are my top five, you know, of the standard classic books, these are if you only have five books in your library, these should be the ones that you have.
Yeah, I have five. Let's see, if I had a choice of five, if you were to put me on a desert island, I'd probably pick Arban, St. Jerome, maybe Clark's Technical Studies, but I've got it memorized, so I don't need it. Maybe some sort of flexibility book like Colin Iron Smith. So maybe one of those. And the Clark Gordon Systematic Approach book has range study stuff in it. I mean, those are all physical things. There are a lot of physical development, but the Arban and St. Jerome have music in them too. So I'd probably say that. But I mean, when I'm telling students to like books to get and telling people things to get, I try to say get every possible flexibility book that you can find, because they're all kind of working on the same thing with tongue level, but they're interesting and they give you different challenges in different ways. So if I were to list those off, it'd be like Walter Smith Lift Flexibilities, Earl Iron's 27 Groups of Exercises, by Lynn, Charles Cullen Advanced Lift Flexibilities, Charles Cullen 100 Original Warm-Ups, Schlossberg, Del Stager's, which I don't think is in print anymore. I mean, there's just a bunch of different books like that. And I would say, like, get all those. You can get, of course, get Arban, St. Jerome, and Clark's Technical Studies. And I mean, so, and then the Clark Gordon stuff with the Systematic Approach book, it has range studies in it, but the point that kind of made the book unique when it first came out was showing people how to combine other books as a routine. But the range studies are, a lot of people don't work on that kind of stuff where you go down as low as you can go and then go up as high as you can go. And it's kind of like you do that once a day and it'll expand what you can do on the trumpet. So, but you can do that with all sorts of things with our, I mean, cause all it is scales and arpeggios, and the book is kind of set up in a very systematic way where you start with a one octave arpeggio, then a two octave, then all these other different things that gradually progress through the book.
Yeah. All right. So I definitely was already going to assume that when you started naming off books, you're definitely going to say Arvin, you're going to definitely say Clark, because those are the standards. I mean, those are the classics. But there's a lot of new stuff that's coming out. So out of some of the newer method books and pedagogy books that have come out, are there any that kind of stick out in your head as being like, yeah, these are some really kind of cool and new approaches to things and that you would maybe recommend people checking out?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I mentioned Arvin, and a lot of people are not using Saint-Jacome now. And then I just have a student that redid, if anyone's getting the International Trumpet Guild, he did a really cool article that in the last journal or so that presented some history behind Saint-Jacome. And I think a lot of people are missing how significant Saint-Jacome is or was. And he also has got a book that's going to come out in about September that's going to be kind of a summary and kind of a guide of how to like get the best out of Saint-Jacome. It's like he kind of put it together through stuff we did with lessons and then expanded some stuff to explain it better and then filled in some of the history. As far as more recent books that have come out, it's like I played through the Alan Vizzuti books are kind of fun. I played through those, and Scott Belk has his flexibility book that's kind of neat to play through. It's different. I look at a lot of different books. There's so many. It's like there's all the French books, like with Colin Claude Gordon. It's like Charlene Beach and Claude Amir and Maxime Alphonse, and there's just so much stuff to get through. I mean, I'm always looking for more stuff. So, and I think kind of what Taken from Claude gave everyone was kind of a framework to like understand everything, and then you could go apply it and work through other materials. So if someone asked me, oh, show me the Claude Gordon routine, like there is no Claude Gordon routine. There's like ideas and thought process and a framework to it. But if some people say, oh, I mean, I don't know, because I didn't take from Bill Adam, but some people say they're going to play the Bill Adam routine. I don't know. There was nothing like that with Claude Gordon, where you did a Claude Gordon routine. It was like, now we're working through Arvin. So like in the course of the 10 years I started with Claude Gordon, I went all the way through Arvin, all the way through Saint-Jacome. Aaron Harris, Advanced Studies, that book is awesome. I don't know that many people are using that much, if you know that book, but it's great. It's kind of, I think it would kind of fit along well with, the Walter Smith Top Tones book. There are just so many great books like that. And I think having the thought process to go through them is the bigger point. Years ago, I used to have an e-commerce section on my website where I would sell all these different books, and I was set up to be a retailer for Carl Fisher and Colin and Hal Leonard and a bunch of different things. So I'd sell all the books that I thought were really cool. And there was a guy that his dad contacted me and said, hey, I want to get all these books. He bought like hundreds of dollars worth of books for me. And I was like, can your son like take some lessons with me? Because it's like he was buying just a boatload of books. I'm like, it's just like throwing all the stuff at you, but not knowing how to go through it. And I think knowing how to go through it is the more important thing, because like when I've taught at a couple colleges before, I would tell some of the students when they were freshmen, I was like, look, we're not going to be able to get through the entire Saint-Jacome book when you're taken from me, because it'll probably take about 6 years. So you'll be out of college. But if I can show you how to like think through this, I'm hoping that you will like keep going with this later, so you understand kind of how to systematically work through things. What I think happens with people when they're practicing, though, is with trumpet players, they get too impatient and they think like, oh, I'm going to skip to the hard stuff at the middle or the end. And they don't realize that all the stuff preceding that is preparing them, and that it's showing the thought process of Arvin or Saint-Jacome or whoever it is to like take that person's knowledge and make it part of you. So if you can learn how to like do that, it'll really help you. One other thing you made me think about earlier was, you were mentioning about people reading books and stuff like that. I think another significant thing with Claude Gordon was getting people to understand the book in context and not just playing the notes in the book, but he wanted you to read everything that was in the book and think about it. Because sometimes people never read what's written in the book, and not that you'll agree with all of it, but a lot of it, like Armin and St. Jacome, had a lot of stuff that I think completely lines up with Claude Gordon, but people just not notice that it's there, you know. And then, like I'll throw out one thing that's kind of funny. In the front part of the Armin book, he says, he basically says, don't think that you're making the sound with your lips buzzing in the cup and the mouthpiece. Some people think it works that way, but it doesn't. I'm paraphrasing it, but it's like, there it is right in the Armin book. He was saying, don't worry about buzzing your mouthpiece, which was kind of a Claude Gordon thing, but a lot of people just glance past it. Or in Armin, he also mentions that your tongue moves in a retrograde motion, which is kind of more in line of what Claude Gordon and Herbert L. Clark taught with K-tongue modified, which is this way of single tonguing where your tip of your tongue and finger on the top edge of your bottom teeth and your tongue is doing that as opposed to up and down like that. But little details like that can change your playing in a big way. So sometimes it's like right there in the book. Like I remember reading a little bit of Herbert L. Clark's characteristic studies and just seeing that and going, okay, and this went on, didn't even get it. But it's like, had I pondered it a little bit, maybe I would have like thought about practicing and thinking about that better, you know?
Yeah. Well, I believe that, there's so much information out there, so many different perspectives on how we do things, why we do things. I don't think any one person corners the market on knowledge. And, if your goal is to make improvement, improvement is generally accomplished by incremental steps. It's small things. And there's a cumulative effect. That's when we see the big improvement. But that big improvement is created by these small incremental steps along the way. And that all of these different books, the perspective of each of the authors was just slightly different. And, like you're saying, like, you know, the different flexibilities, it's like, okay, well, yeah, there's some things that maybe by Lynn, the way he approaches a specific aspect, that's the best way of gaining that kind of particular skill. And then you take like Scott's book. I mean, I know Scott well. Scott's got a little more whimsical approach, but also his is a little more, more suited towards particularly commercial players. So some of the stuff that's going on in there is just really, really applicable for people in the commercial field. So it's like, oh, okay, well, one of those studies could really be exceptionally beneficial, maybe more beneficial than the by Lynn. And conversely, something by Lynn might be more, beneficial than Scott's, depending on your situation. So how do you, it seems like you as the teacher then have to spend a whole lot of time diving into these books to try and discern where the book is coming from and where its unique strengths and weaknesses are so that you can best prescribe that as part of someone's training curriculum. So, how do you find the time to do all that?
Yeah, well, that's where I like have a practice routine for myself and work through these books. And usually I wouldn't assign something to a student if I haven't like gone through it in my own personal practice. That was kind of a Claude Gordon thing. Even though he'd retired from playing, he would always practice his trumpet and go through various aspects of things that he was thinking about creating or giving to students. Like for example, a couple of my students right now, I'm giving them some exercises from this book called Gettke. It's a German, it's a trombone method book, a flexibility book. It's not written in treble clef, it's only bass clef. And I've given a few of my students that, and as we've gone through it, I'm like, hold up, let's change the order of these things. Let's add some other things in there. Cause I'm always thinking about how to make it more systematic to where it's not just plowing through the book, but maybe there's a way to like fill in some gaps. There's a little short video I put up like several weeks or months ago. There's a book that Claude Gordon used to use called, I never knew it came from this book. It's called How Brass Players Do It by a guy named John Ridgeon. And I was teaching this student from England and he recognized the exercises. And he was like, wait, I think I know where this came from. So he pulled the book out and said, here it is. And I was like, I never saw the book because Claude Gordon literally did cut and paste and like stuck them on a piece of paper. And then he wrote some other exercises to fill in the gaps to make it more systematic or progressive. And so I'm always thinking, how can I make that better? So it might be making it progressive with the revising the order that I go through it, or adding more keys or different articulations or combining other material with it. And I always feel like that's one of the things that makes teaching fun, because I always feel like I'm thinking of new ways to like say, okay, I'm going to do this and this and combine this in here and weave these things all together in a way that I feel is like progressive, you know? And to answer your question, like, or kind of go back to what you're saying about Scott's book, there's so many different books like that. I kind of look at it as the goal is to be overall really versatile. So it doesn't matter if you're playing commercial music, jazz, classical, hip hop, big band, whatever you can think of, just be a good trumpet player. And I kind of look at it as that is like the overall thing. Cause like Claude was not, he was not like a jazzer and he didn't play classical music. That, I mean, he was kind of a studio musician, and his big band stuff, if you listen to it, kind of sounded like Herbert L. Clark meets big band. And it was like, maybe not the thing I'd want to listen to very much, but you could tell it was really skillful. And overall, he was like a really skillful trumpet player. So I look at it as, I kind of think of it as, years ago, I used to work out, go to the gym. I need to do that again. But I had a really good trainer. And the guy would always give me, I liked it because I'd go and we'd meet and he'd give me an assignment for about a week or two. And then it would keep progressing. And then then at a certain point, I wouldn't lose weight. I wouldn't gain more strength. And I kind of hit like a plateau. And then he'd switch it up into a new set of things. And it's like, whoa, there's something else to do. And then as that I mastered that, I could probably go back and do the other thing better. So I kind of think that trumpet playing is and practicing is like that, where you're working through a book, you're gaining all this stuff out of it. And then you stay on it long enough for it to change you. Then you move to another book and work through that and then another one. And then you might circle back around and go back through the book again and be like, whoa, I got something new out of this from that. And now I'm like in a different place. So it's like there's always ways to pull stuff out of it, where if all we ever did was practice the same thing all the time, it would be just like going to the gym and working out the same exact exercise all the time. You just like not get anywhere after a while. So it's like, that's why it's got to be like working through things. And it makes it challenging because, I mean, it makes it fun for me as a teacher and practicing. And I mean, it's one of the things where I feel like, that's why I know that I'm kind of called or meant to teach. I mean, I feel like teaching is the thing that makes me more excited than even playing. Even though I like to practice my trumpet, it's like teaching it is exciting.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you there. I mean, I love to learn and I love to teach. So those are two of the most important things to me. And I think that's for me. That's the way I learned the best is, to take something to try and break it down and then try to figure out how to explain it to somebody else. Because, you know, talking about that Einstein quote, the deeper I dive into it and the clearer my ability to explain it is, then that means I'm understanding it on a new level. And so, I really admire people who are great teachers. And I think everybody should teach in some respect. If they're trying to really improve their skills, it will open your eyes. If you're being humble and honest, it will open your eyes.
Yeah, but, definitely.
All right. Well, we have got a few standard segments that we need to get to on the show today before we can wrap up. And the first one is brought to us by none other than Mr. Michael Barkley of Barkley Microphones. That's right, folks. Our favorite, the mic of choice for the Trumpet Guru and its guest. And I think even as I'm speaking, that Mr. Jeff is grabbing his Barkley microphone out of his case there.
Yeah, two of them. So here's a red one.
yes, the new color models. I've got a purple one on order. So yes, I'm telling you, in all honesty, Mike's stuff is the shit. So you definitely need to check it out. And if you're taking virtual lessons, you need to have a good microphone. So even if you're not doing studio work, you should have a good microphone if you're going to do those virtual lessons, because it's going to help your teacher to hear you better. So there you go. Another good reason to buy a microphone. But this segment is called Sound Off, and Sound Off is about sound. And what I kind of like to get it is your thought on the approach to generating that beautiful trumpet sound. Now, obviously, everybody's got different equipment they're working with, be it the physical equipment of the horn or the real physical equipment of their chops. But you know, how do you go about addressing sound issues with your students?
Are you talking about what equipment do I use, or just the concept?
How do you help them get the concepts of sound?
Okay, so it's hard to describe sound, because some people say that bright or dark or whatever. And I remember asking this question to Claude Gordon before, like, what's a good sound? Because when I was in school, people would say, oh, this person's too bright or they're too dark. And his definition was a free vibration. So that's kind of what I'm looking for first, is like the sound is like free, to where it's not like tight or restricted. And then the other word that I like to describe is resonant, because being that I've played around with ham radio and everything for so long, one of the things that immediately came to my mind is that when you have a transmitter and an antenna, the antenna has a resonant frequency and your transmitter is transmitting. And if you're not on the same exact resonant frequency, you get this thing called SWR, which is some of the power is coming back down your feed line or your coax, and it's not being transmitted off your antenna. So in the same sort of way, when people practice the trumpet, if they're not playing on what some people call centered on the pitch, or I prefer to use the word resonant, if you're not right on the resonant frequency, you're kind of working against the trumpet. So you can kind of hear that, where the sound is full and clear and has overtones in it. But if you're flat in relation to that resonant frequency, it'll be kind of like dull and kind of dead sounding and kind of a little spread. Or if you're sharp in relation to that, it's kind of a little pinched and it's different. So I'm wanting them to hear and feel that when they're practicing, you know, like the flexibility studies, I'm trying to get them to experience that and feel that. And also when they're doing intervals and arpeggios and scales, so they can really hear where they are, like intonation wise and intervals and where they're centering in on pitch. So I feel that that is a physical thing that results in the sound being the right way. So I look at the two, that's like a important ingredient. Now someone might be playing a different mouthpiece or a different trumpet, and their tone might be a little bit different based on their equipment. But if they have that quality to it, I feel like that's what I want them to get. And then you might have the preference to get a darker sound and someone else might want to have a brighter sound, and they can both be great, because it's like, that's your desire and your personality coming out and what you want to sound like with your playing. So that's kind of my concept of sound, is more the general, like the freeness and the resonance and that kind of thing. And then the variation in bright or dark or that, all that kind of stuff is more on the personal side, you know?
I like it. I never really heard anybody use that free vibration phrase before. So I like that. It's a different way of thinking about it. So very good. All right. Let's move on to the next segment. Next segment is called Geared Up. And Geared Up is brought to us by Venture Mouthpieces, Venture, where technology, design, and craftsmanship intersect. Use the code TrumpetGurus21 to get 10% off your order. And this is, you know, about gear. We can't talk trumpet without talking gear. And yeah, everybody's got different concepts on gear, as you were just alluding to a few moments ago. You know, the, you know, people might want to change their gear based on how to get that specific kind of color to their sound that they're looking for. But as a teacher, how do you approach the subject of gear, particularly being, you know, having so many virtual students where, you know, you can't walk, you can't be like the old teacher who would, you know, walk into the store with their student, or, you know, have the bring in a bunch of student horns into the studio and have them try it out. So how do you suggest people go about the process of fine tuning their gear?
So teaching, what I usually do, I definitely address gear, but I first want to make sure that they're practicing and all that kind of stuff is happening first. And then I usually ask them questions about what they're playing, if they change, how long they've been playing on certain things, what sorts of playing they do. And then as they're playing through parts of the routine, I can kind of hear certain things. Like, for example, if the equipment sounds like it's backing up on them and I can tell that they're doing everything pretty well and pretty correctly, then I might suggest, like, hey, what are you playing on? You might want to, like, consider opening up the throat or the back bore or changing some things on it. But I'm very careful to, like, not get them off into a tangent of trying stuff, trying equipment changes, because I want them to keep consistency. So I kind of look at it as, like, if you're going to do something like that, really approach it kind of in like a scientific way, where you keep your routine exactly the same way for a while to where you feel like you're really super stable, and then say, okay, I've got the mouthpiece that I've been playing on for a long time. Now I'm going to make one change to that, or change like a couple things, like try a couple changes, and then be like, okay, I'm going to play this for a while and get used to it, and then make a judgment on it. Where I think when you change equipment, there's that adjustment period where if you're not really adjusted to it, then you go change to something else. Now you don't know what's causing what, you know? So I kind of look at, like, that's important. Now, what I personally play on, I mean, I'm kind of boring. I've not switched mouthpieces since 1984 or trumpets. I'm, like, really kind of boring, but I mean, some people would say this is, like, really not, like, how could you play lead on it or how could you do whatever, but it's like the CG Personal mouthpieces made by Canstle. It's got, I don't know if you can really tell, it's got like a 20 throat in it. So it's pretty big and it's kind of deep where if I put my finger in it, it's about that deep. And it's more kind of a V shape in there. And the back bore is pretty wide and open in the back. Like if you were to look at it, it's like what would be called like a Schmidt back bore. So like this way, it would taper like this, as opposed to like in a Schilke 14A4A, it kind of tapers like that. This one opens up like that, what some people might call like a orchestral or symphonic back bore. I don't think that it makes it harder. I actually feel that once you're used to it, it makes it easier. But again, I don't switch around. So who knows if I switch around all the time, but that's kind of what I think with equipment. Once people find it, you know, then get back on practicing and forget about it. Then it just becomes like it's your home base and you don't have to think about equipment. So you pick your horn up and it's like you're thinking about playing instead of what this or that feels like, you know?
All right. Well, that is some solid advice. So thank you very much for that input. All right, so we've got a final segment, and this is brought to us by our good friend Kenny Robinson of Robinson's Remedies. This is the Robinson's Remedy Rapid Fire Round, and this is just a series of questions that kind of bounce all over the place, kind of like, you know, doing pedal tones. So you're just fluttering along in the wind, and we're just going to see how quickly you can respond to these questions. Are you ready, Jeff?
Okay.
All right. Let's do it. First question, who is the biggest influence on your life that is not a trumpet player?
I'm a Christian, so I guess I would say Jesus.
All right. What is your favorite book?
If we're talking about, I like to read the book of Proverbs.
Okay. We'll accept that answer. All right. What's the worst movie you've ever seen?
Oh, Ishtar.
You didn't like Ishtar?
No, it's so bad I can't even remember very much of it, but I just remember it was horrible.
All right. If you weren't a trumpet player, what would you want to be?
Probably something with computers or electronics.
All right. What is your favorite drink?
I like, let's see. Oh, what was it? I'm forgetting the brand name. I like bourbon, but there's a particular bourbon that is, I'm drawing a blank on it. Double Oak.
Woodford?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So that's my favorite. I always go back to that when I go in the store.
That's a good one. All right. You are going to have a dinner party, and you can invite any three living people in the world to come and hang out with you for an evening of discussion, avoiding close family and friends. So who are the three people you'd love to have at your dinner party?
Oh, man. I'm friends with Lee Loughnane, so I'd probably invite him. And then this would be kind of crazy. Joe Walsh, who I've talked to him before from the Eagles. He's a ham operator. Right. He's crazy. And third one, let's see, who would I invite? Who else? I don't know. Maybe like I don't know who else. He's no longer alive, but it'd be cool, Maurice André.
Well, that's the second part of the question. The second part of the question is, you could invite any three people that are no longer with us, three people from history. Who would you want to have?
Maurice André, Claude Gordon, and Timofey Dokshitser.
Okay. There'd be some good talk there. Next question, lacquer plated or raw?
I like silver plating.
All right. What is your favorite quote?
There's this, I think it's, I don't know if it's like Steve Jobs or if it's Guy Kawasaki, but it was something like, don't let the bozos grind you down. Well, there are people that are sometimes really discouraging that try to tell you you can't do something, and you just got to ignore that.
Yeah, there you go. All right, what is your greatest fear?
I'm not really afraid of anything, but I think if I were to lose my mental capacity, you know, like ability to think, I mean, I wouldn't. Like, say if I were to get old and lose my ability to move around or something like that, my ability to think, I think that would be probably the worst thing for me.
All right. You could be granted one superpower. What would it be?
Maybe reading people's minds.
Yeah.
It might be a bad thing.
Yeah. In a whole lot of trouble. All right. What aspect of trumpet playing do you find to be the most overrated?
Probably like fast technical playing, because I feel that it's possible for anyone to do that pretty easily.
All right. And what aspect do you find to be the most underrated?
Flexibility, I guess.
All right. You can go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice about music. What would it be?
I feel like when I was younger, I was too self-conscious about taking solos and improvising. I wish I would have done that a lot younger. I mean, it wasn't until probably after college that I felt like I was comfortable doing that. And had I just tried more when I was younger, I think it would have been better, you know, and not be afraid to mess up or get self-conscious about things.
Now, you're back there and you're going to give your younger self one piece of advice about life.
Probably, maybe take even more risks.
Sometimes you just got to let it fly. And our final question for you, Jeff, is what do you want your legacy to be?
That the pedagogy stuff from Claude Gordon will help others to know how to use method books and improve their practicing for years or generations in the future. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, that.
You want me to say that again?
Sure. let's go with what do you want your legacy to be? Fine.
That the pedagogy of Claude Gordon and the use of all the different method books in a systematic practice routine and how to keep all these books alive would be something I'm remembered for.
All right. Well, you're certainly taking steps to that daily, and certainly appreciate you taking time to share some of your insights. And, you know, well, we'll have links in the show notes. So if you want to find out more about Jeff, please hop on over to his webpage. Also check out his YouTube channel. Lots of great content on there. And, you know, I think it's so important. You know, too many people want to know what to practice. And I think it's more important often to understand how to practice. And, you know, you're doing a great job of giving the hows and the whats. So thank you very much for your contribution to the world of crazy trumpet players.
Thanks.
So thank you very much for spending time with us on today's episode of The Hang. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to drop them to us. And if you have a request for a future topic or guest, please hit me up at thetrumpetgurus@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to help you out. So as always, folks, until next time, peace and slide grease. We out.
Thanks for hanging with us today. This podcast is all about creating deeper connections through our mutual love of music and the trumpet life. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast and also like and share this episode with a friend. We want to see The Hang grow for show. Please support our sponsors and consider becoming a personal supporter of this podcast as well. Remember, for less than the price of a bottle of valve oil a month, you can keep this podcast moving smoothly. The Trumpet Guru's Hang is recorded at the Candy Factory, a co-working space and social club located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Jose Johnson is the executive producer. Post-production editing is by Mitch Bowers. Our opening theme song was composed and performed by Lexi Signal, and our closing theme music comes courtesy of The Greatest Funeral Ever. Incidental music is by Ethan Swayze and Jose Johnson. Graphic design by Ann Kirby of The Sweet Corps. The Trumpet Guru's Hang podcast is produced in collaboration with the So Good Lancaster Media Group.